Well, since the last crime against the peace.
That's right. So what have you been doing other than just sitting and writing?
I have mostly, well, sitting at home and writing, if you're dealing with a subject as colourful as this, is rather fun, because Brazil is one of my favourite places, and I spent a lot of time down there doing this book. And I like getting into different cultures and different societies. So my books become my life for the time that I'm working on them, now that I have the luxury of being a full-time writer. And it's wonderful. I'm having the best time, not only of my life, but that I could ever have conceived of.
Well, when I read I guess it's the prologue, right? The prologue?
The prologue.
Yeah, the prologue. You really caught the flavor of 1936, which was a very good year. That was my year.
Not a bad vintage.
I don't remember the year, other than, but that was the year I came into the world. And so you really had the flavor. You must have done a lot of... you would remember that year, because you had to be too young.
I know it now. I mean, I've been back there. But I've been there as a tourist. I mean, I wasn't around when it happened. I've had to recreate it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful period. I mean, this was the time of Marlene Dietrich and her glory days. And all the atmosphere that implies. I mean, the days of dangerous blue ladies in Shanghai and so on. And Rio in those days, as I conceive it, was probably the most extraordinary city on the face of the globe. A city of intrigue, a Casablanca of the Western Hemisphere, a city that tourists hadn't discovered, a city for potentates and maharajas having exotic and complicated affairs out of the sight of their own people. Wonderful, wonderful terrain.
Well, there was one bad thing about 1936, no penicillin.
No penicillin. Yes, the Brazilians were terribly obsessed. I suppose most people were obsessed with getting syphilis in those days. And, you know, Brazil is a country that has a very easygoing attitude towards sensualism and sex and illicit affairs and so on. I mean, there are no hang-ups. I mean, it's a totally uninhibited society. Always has been. In 1936, Brazilian gentlemen would make a point of always drinking coffee, holding the cup with their left hand, because they were worried that the previous user of the coffee cup, who would presumably have used it with his right hand, might have had syphilis, and they thought they might contract the disease by drinking from the same side of the cup. Of course, their theory didn't get them out of danger, because since half of them were using their left hand to hold the cup, they were sipping from the same side anyway. But this was one of the many worries Brazilians had in that time.
Well, tell me about Carnival of Spies. And here we have a young man named Johnny who... becomes an ardent communist over the years and becomes disillusioned. Tell me how this idea came about and what you did to shock this book into being.
I've been looking for an excuse to set a novel in Brazil for a long time. The country fascinates me, the lushness, the color, the richness, the romance of the society, its landscapes. And I finally realized I'd found the ideal plot for a historical novel, which is also a good spy story, when I ran into an elderly gentleman in Canada who, hearing of my interest in Brazil, said, you know, one of the most remarkable double agents of the 20th century was in Brazil in the 1930s, trying to start a revolution for Stalin. I had never heard of this character. His real name was Johann Heinrich de Graaf. He was a German, born like my fictional hero around the turn of the century. And like my fictional hero, a man who became a communist revolutionary out of belief, out of fervid belief that the Soviet model was going to solve the problems of mankind. And again, like my fictional hero, later on became disillusioned when he found out that Stalin was doing backroom deals with Hitler and decided to do something about his former bosses. And what he did was to walk in on the British and become a double agent for them and blow up a number of well-laid Soviet schemes in the 30s. So there I had a character who was in Brazil in the 1930s, bringing together as a fictional enterprise a remarkable hero. You know, not a great man, not one of the largest people in history, a little man, stumbling and falling, who fought against great odds and under great danger to do something he believed in. Against the backdrop of Brazil, there was the magic that I had to work with. And in the real life background of the story is also the fact that this is a man who loved two women who were sisters, who were both Soviet agents, who were both deadly, and all the problems and opportunities associated with that.
Mm. Were you able to go to Brazil?
Oh, yes, yes. I first went to Brazil in 1972 when I was a reporter for The Economist magazine in London, writing one of the endless special reports we used to do on various countries. I had the opportunity to travel all over the place.
But there must have been enormous changes since the 1930s.
Well, enormous changes, and yet, you know, part of Brazil is timeless, for good or bad. I mean, this is an undiscovered frontier in a lot of ways. I mean, there are thousands and thousands of square miles of Brazil that have not been opened for any kind of so-called development. There are Indians who are still cannibals and still practicing primitive religions. In the Northeast, there is still a largely African population who preserves intact the culture and religion of Yoruba Nigeria, which the slaves brought with them to Brazil. And so although part of Brazil is modern, thrusting into the future, trying to make a buck, getting itself into debt and all sorts of problems, another part of that country is ageless. And it is possible, you know, to go back not just half a century, but longer if you want to.
Are you going to stick with the fictional form, or do you have any plans to go back to journalism at some point?
Well, the interesting thing to me, Don, since I've had the luxury of being a full-time writer, is that I've been able to think a lot about what I want to do and what I ought to be doing. And I finally realized that what I wanted to do at 14, which was to write good, major, historical novels, is what it is for me to do now. Carnival of Spies is my first historical novel. It's a spy story. It has elements in it very recognizable to readers of my previous books. But it's also a historical novel involving a great deal of research and a great effort to re-enter the mind, the society, the culture of a different period. My ambition now is to embark on a great cycle of historical novels, which will take me back to the 18th century initially, back to the era of the French and Indian Wars and the first frontier of America, the Mohawks, the Iroquois, some of the great characters who were alive at that time and have now been forgotten, and bring back that portion of history which we ought to remember, which involves the roots of this country and what makes it possible.
Well, that's certainly... completely out of your element at this point, isn't it?
Well, not really. I mean, I've been interested in a lot of things, and, you know, predictable people are boring. I'm sure we'd agree on that. I mean, I like ambiguity, and I like change, and I like people who not only break the mold, but don't really have a mold to begin with. When I was an academic, which was early on in my career, I suppose when I was still respectable instead of being an unemployed scribbler who's knocked about a bit, I started a PhD thesis on the Maya civilization of Central America. I lectured in ancient Near Eastern history. I wrote a thesis on the colonial and post-colonial history of Ghana in West Africa. I'm interested in a lot of things. History is one of them, because history is the story of men and women under stress, dealing with problems of change and societies in crisis. And, you know, as has been said too many times, I suppose, but is eternally true, if we don't remember history, we're condemned to repeat it. And how do you bring it back? The novel is the best possible way. That's how you make the bones live. So that is essentially what I want to do. And I can't think of anything more satisfying to do.
Well, as an Australian or ex-Australian...
Boy from the bush.
Some of your compatriots are very good historical writers. Thomas Keneally wrote The Confederates.
Indeed.
And Robert Hughes, The Fatal Shore, recently, about the convicts who were sent to Australia. It must run in the blood, huh?
You know, you probably heard the story of the school teacher who stood up in front of his class, Don, and said... give me liberty or give me death. Who said that? Silence in the room. Finally, a little hand goes up at the back, and it's the Japanese exchange student, and he says, Patrick Henry. The teacher is pleased that somebody answered the question, but furious that none of the American school kids knew the answer to the question, and in his wrath he says, it is outrageous that we need a Japanese exchange student to tell us our own history. Screw the Japanese, calls someone from the back of the room. The teacher in deeper fury says, who said that? The Japanese hand goes up again, and the kid says, Harry Truman, 1945. The point is, Americans, and it's not exclusive to Americans, most of us in Western societies seem to have an awfully difficult time remembering history, even when it's very relevant to us and we ought to know about it. One of the bits of history I wanted to recall in Carnival of Spies is that there was once something called the Nazi-Soviet Pact, and there were certain backroom dealings that led to it. There are other corners of history we ought to know more about, like... you know, who are the Indians in American society? What did they mean to us? What did we do to them? But the question that any of us who want kids to understand history have to answer is the biblical one. Shall these bones live? How do you make the bones live? How do you make it alive? How do you make it matter? The novelist holds the key to that, in my opinion, in my very humble opinion, because history is too important to be left to professional historians. You need people who can breathe a little fire into it.
Are you comfortable writing so now?
Writing what?
Solo. Writing
solo? I've never done anything else.
Well, of course, your collaborator, Arnold Borchgrav, worked with you on a couple of very successful books. Do you miss that collaboration?
No. I mean, Arno and I had a very successful partnership. We have our names on two books together. It's no secret that I was the one who put the words on paper. I mean, Arno helped with the research, and we would discuss things together. But, Don, you know, for two men to get together and conceive a book is like three people getting together to have a baby. I mean, it is a difficult sexual operation, a difficult creative operation. Arno's a splendid fellow and a pal of mine, and I don't regret the fact that we wrote a book together which was the number one bestseller in this country and gave me, eventually, the independence to go out and write what I want to do. But any writer, any truly creative spirit, knows that he has to conceive and execute in isolation. That is the only way it is done.
Yeah, I don't see how a fiction writer can collaborate efficiently.
You absolutely cannot. It is impossible. You can collaborate on certain aspects of the project. You can discuss general ideas. You can combine research. You can share out bits and pieces of the scaffolding. But the finished building has to be the work of one hand. That is the way it always is.
Also, philosophically, it would seem to me that you and Arno would be pretty far apart. Did you have any disputes in the execution of
Well, I find as I get older, I'm getting more dangerously liberal, at least in the opinions of my conservative friends, Don. As a matter of fact, I would put it this way. As I get older, my political attitude is approximately the following. I divide the world into the party that has a sense of humor and the party that doesn't. I belong to the party that has a sense of humor, and I am against those who don't. This is one of the most important human intellectual and political divides there is, and it sounds like a joke, and it is, of course, but it's also something more than a joke. I find that being a novelist and enjoying being a novelist requires me to do what, in fact, fascinates me most, which is to get at the muddle of human motivations all the time. And, you know, the French say in one of their proverbs, to understand everything is to forgive everything. If you understand what makes a man or a woman tick, you find it very hard to put things in black and white, you know, to be right-wing or left-wing or whatever. You judge people on in an individual basis. Now, Arno remains a journalist and a politically conscious fellow and so on. It's easier for him, I think, to put things in black and white than it is for me. I've got interested in the murky areas of human life. So perhaps I'm becoming a dangerous liberal.
Well, I hope you invite Arno to your 1930s party and give him a few drinks and loosen him up a little bit. Maybe he'll be the life of the party. You never
well,
know.
He doesn't lack a sense of humor. I think he can take a lot in his stride.
Now, Kuchet's an outgoing guy, and you've done a lot of traveling, and you meet well with people, and yet here you have adopted the life of a solitary writer. Is this difficult to reconcile, locking yourself in the room while at the same time probably itching to get out and talk to people?
Well, it's not quite as inhibited and circumscribed as you make out, Don, because as I may have said earlier, my books become my life. I sometimes feel I should go and burn incense and say a prayer to someone or something for having the luxury of this being so, of having my books become my life. But the research that I do is not just literary research. I go deeply into the societies that interest me. For example, at the moment I'm working on historical novels involving the American Indians. I've been spending a great deal of time on Indian reserves. I'm in process of being adopted into an Indian nation. I have learnt part of its language. I intend to become fluent. I've been admitted to traditional rituals and customs which white men are not normally admitted to. And this is a great privilege for me. And it is different in some ways from the other things I've done and explored, but not in the intensity. I mean, I get involved. I get involved with people. In researching Carnival of Spies, I got involved with, for example, former Brazilian revolutionaries who were trying to blow up the country in the 1930s, who told me stories of their lives, which are absolutely wonderful. I participated in the northeast of Brazil in Candomblé ceremonies of the Afro-Brazilian religion, which, again, whites don't have access to normally in their full depth and interest. Then, of course, there is the solitary process. This is part of writing. Every writer knows it. Without it, you couldn't get anything on paper to begin with. That can be agonizing, terrifying, boring, all the rest of it. But in its high moments, in its soaring moments, it is the greatest source of exaltation a writer can know. When things are going well, when the characters are alive, when they're running around and doing things he never anticipated, that is a moment of pure magical beauty. And it makes everything else you may have to put up with worthwhile.
Are you doing most or all of your writing upstate in your
Well, I've place? You know, I've adopted the life of, I suppose, of a rural squire. I bought myself a farm in upstate New York. I can pull up my drawbridge. It is God's own country as far as I'm concerned. It's very beautiful up there. I can listen to the running streams. I can walk my dogs in the deep woods. I can close off the outside world when I want to. And that, for part of my life, is perfect. For the other part, being a fellow who's always liked to stir up trouble in different situations and get himself embroiled in trouble, who's always liked the smell of gunpowder, I suppose, I like to vary that with field work, to put it in a respectable phrase, which involves my rushing off to exotic situations and getting fully immersed with the people there.
Well, Robert Moss, I know you have a plane that leaves in about 5 minutes. I'm sure you'll get out to LaGuardia in time or wherever you're going. I thank you very much. This was kind of an abbreviated chat, but I did want to have you in, and you're always interesting and delightful to talk to. In fact, I think I could just turn on the microphone and let you go and go to another room. Robert Moss, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. A pleasure as always.
Thank you.